I'm so glad that you guys are enjoying each other, but I'm going to ask you to take your seat so we can get started. So welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the break and enjoyed having an opportunity to get to know one another from the volume in this room. I think there's probably a lot of really good conversations going on, so that's always exciting. Our next speaker is Trey Allen. He's from the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Government, and he joined the school in 2013. Before that, he was an attorney at Therrington Smith LLP in Raleigh, where he represented local school boards. Prior to that, he served as a law clerk for Justice Paul M. Newby of the North Carolina Supreme Court and a judge advocate in the U.S. Marine Corps. Allen earned a bachelor's degree from the University of North Carolina at Pembroke and a law degree from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he was a published staff member of the North Carolina Law Review. So we're really glad that he could be with us here today. And without further ado, Trey Allen.
Thank you. So I have to stay right here. So if you don't mind telling me a few of the boards that you represent. Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Housing Advisory Board. Community Design Commission. Police Advisory Board. Public Art? Yes, sir, in the back. Board of Adjustment? Great. Yes. Planning? Okay. Parks and Rec? Justice in Action? Library? Love it. Okay. Personnel Commission? Raise your hand if you're under the impression that your board performs only advisory functions. You don't make decisions, in other words. All right, raise your hand if you believe that your board does make decisions. Okay. Official meetings of public bodies are subject to the public notice requirements of the open meetings law. Moreover, records made or received in the transaction of public business can be subject to the public records law. I'm going to be unpacking those two statements in my presentation today. But because this topic is so dreadfully boring, I thought I might start with a few jokes. And because my joke-telling style is so dreadfully boring, I thought I would present the jokes to you visually. And because I like grammar, the jokes are all grammar related. Just have to let it wash over you. This next one is really good. A comma can make a big difference. And then the next one is my all-time favorite. All right, let's talk about open meetings. What is an open meeting? I shouldn't say what is an open meeting. What kind of meeting is subject to the open meetings law? Specifically, did the public notice and access requirements of the open meetings law? An official meeting of a public body. Raise your hand if you think you belong to a public body. Raise your hand if you think you don't belong to a public body. Raise your hand if you're not sure whether you belong to a public body. Raise your hand if you only raised your hand in response to the question about whether you belong to a public body because you saw everyone else raising their hands. Well, from what I heard, it sounds to me like you indeed all do belong to public bodies under the open meetings law. I'm not sure. Okay. So what is a public body as defined by the law? It's an entity with at least two members that's intentionally created or appointed, that's governmental in nature, but not private, and that exercises any one of five functions. And those are the five functions: legislative, policymaking, quasi-judicial, administrative, or advisory. Now, when we say intentionally created or appointed, what do we mean? Who has to create the body for it to satisfy this criterion? Any idea? Well, who created your city council? The General Assembly, right? There's a charter, which is a law passed by the General Assembly. And then there are state statutes, general statutes, that also apply to the operation of your city council. So it's been created by the General Assembly. Your boards, some of them are created by statute, but all of them are under the authority of the city council, right? And some of them are created solely by the city council. There's really nothing in statute about them at all. But they've been created by some governmental authority, all right? If I appoint my three sons as a committee to clean the playroom, they're not subject to the open meetings law because I'm not a governmental authority, right? So that's how that works. What would be an example, do you think, of a legislative function? Well, let me ask you this. Do you think any of you exercise a legislative function? I don't think so. Who does? Your council, right? It exercises a legislative function when it adopts an ordinance. That's a law, right? It's a local law. Or it amends an ordinance. What about a policymaking function? Do any of you make policy? These are not purely rhetorical questions. I don't necessarily know. All right, normally that's something that's done by your governing board, right? So your city council in this case. What about quasi-judicial? I heard some board of adjustment folks right there. You exercise quasi-judicial function, right? And community design commission, can you explain to me how you exercise a quasi-judicial function? Okay, so you have final decision-making authority on some things that affect individual people, right? Individual citizens, right? All right, administrative. Now we have some HR personnel. That's an example of, can be an example of some administrative functions. And it sounded to me like perhaps the majority of you perform advisory functions. So you're giving input, I would assume in most cases, to the city council about whatever matters fall within your purview, right? Well, that's a function that can qualify an entity as a public body under the public records law. Any questions about that? Interesting questions come up when we talk about nonprofits that have a close relationship to a government entity. And I don't think think I heard anyone say that they're here from a nonprofit board, but you're probably aware that, that those types of relationships exist. And many people assume that if it's a nonprofit entity, that it's not subject to the open meetings law, but the law is not that clear. The law is rarely clear. If the relationship between a nonprofit entity and, say, a city council is a purely a funding relationship, the city council appropriates funds that go to this nonprofit and doesn't exercise any control over the internal operations of the nonprofit, then the nonprofit may well not qualify as a public body for purposes of the open meetings law. But there are many cases, instances in which a governing board will have the right to appoint members to a nonprofit's board, and it might be the case that if the board should dissolve, or if the nonprofit rather should dissolve, that its assets would go back to the or go to the governmental entity. And in those kinds of situations, you can have a nonprofit board that is subject to the open meetings law. And there are some other factors you see there, boards that are created by government or staffed by government can be subject to the open meetings law, even though technically they're nonprofit corporations. All right, so you got to have two things. You got to have, for the open meetings law to apply, you got to have the public body, right? And we've satisfied ourselves that we're all part of public bodies. And then you have to have an official meeting. So to know whether the open meetings law applies to what you're doing, you have to know what counts as an official meeting as well. Sorry, I lost the cursor. So to have an official meeting, you have to have a majority of the members of the public body that have gathered in person or electronically for one of the purposes that you see listed there. Now, how many of you allow, do you have, raise your hand if you have electronic participation members? What I said was, raise your hand if you have members participating electronically in your meetings. My understanding is you don't allow that in Chapel Hill. Right? Now, this is a probably more of a footnote, but this question comes up frequently in the context of governing boards, city councils, boards of county commissioners. You'll have a member who will be upset, who will say, I can't be at a particular meeting. I want to participate by phone. And there are rules in the open meetings law, there are provisions in the open meetings law that address electronic participation in meetings. The member will think, I have a right to participate electronically by telephone. Well, that is not the case. What the open meetings law does, essentially, is it says if there is electronic participation in meetings, it has to meet certain requirements that I'm not going to go into because they're not an issue for you, because you don't allow electronic participation in board meetings here. Essentially, it's up to your governing board, in your case, your city council, to decide whether members of the city council can participate electronically in meetings and whether members of any of the advisory boards or other boards that report to the city council can report in a meeting. So we don't need to spend too much time on the gather in person or electronically. However, let me put this to you. What about email exchanges with members of a board? So raise your hand if you ever communicate with other board members via email or text message, for that matter. All right. So that happens frequently. There is nothing per se wrong with that. But suppose it's an email. Well, raise your hand if all members of your board are copied on these emails. It's okay. I'm not going to report you. I know the mayor's back there. Okay, and that is also not necessarily a problem, but just be aware of this. Now, I haven't actually covered the notice requirements yet, so this may be putting the cart a little before the horse. But if you are engaged in simultaneous communication. That word simultaneous is used in the statute. That by a, if a majority of board members are engaged in simultaneous communication, either in person or electronically, that is an official meeting. All right, if you're using it for one of these purposes. If it's let's all have a barbecue, that's different. But if it's for one of these purposes that you see listed on the right on the slide, then it's an official meeting, and you could then well be in violation of the open meetings law. All right. Any questions about that? Yes. So she has to walk forward to hear. Or I will just repeat the question next time.
I have a question. And it is, say that there is some information that is pertinent to whatever discussion has been going, but the information is tangential, is not a way to influence it, but provided more information. Is, if I am doing that and I copy to everybody, I've been unlawful?
Okay, that's a good question. And the answer is probably not. If you look under purposes, and this is a good time to go through the purposes. The purposes include conduct a hearing, deliberate, vote on public business, or otherwise transact the public business.
I just wanted to add something onto what she was saying, which is that I think it's important to know the difference between some of our normal standing advisory boards and our quasi-judicial boards, because in that case, a quasi-judicial board receiving any kind of extra information could cause a legal problem.
So we're not talking quasi-judicial, right? The aspect of the purposes that you'd be maybe concerned about is the deliberate part, because that includes receiving information. It can include receiving information. Now, if you're just sending an email to folks with some information that's relevant to their official business, and there's not a back and forth about it that is roughly simultaneous in nature, then it's not a meeting. So I am not saying you can't send emails to your board. In that case, I would say it's the equivalent of leaving a memo in someone's mailbox. Right? Just sharing information alone is not a violation of the open meetings law. If it's whether there's this sort of back and forth, and whether the back and forth can be aptly characterized as simultaneous. And I was, as I don't know that you got this from what Jennifer said from the introduction, but I represented school boards for about 6 years. So I always got nervous whenever they started going back and forth, board members started going back and forth on email. And occasionally I'd have to pipe in and say, you know, please remember that simultaneous communication can be a violation of open meetings law. No, because it would violate the attorney-client privilege. It could be anything, because, or almost anything, because the definition of public business is so broad under the open meetings law. If it concerns really the public business in any way, then it can be a violation if the communication is simultaneous. Now, if it's board member writes an email and somebody else replies 2 days later, and then that is not a violation. But sometimes, oftentimes, people nowadays spend the bulk of their time at a computer, and it's not unusual for there to be a pretty quick back and forth. Okay. Yes, sir. So if it's two members, just two people, then you have to look at a couple of things. How big is the public body? If it's a three-member public body, then you've got a majority anytime two of them are together, either in person or virtually. But if there's an exchange and all the boards copied, then even though everyone doesn't chime in, I think you could still run into a problem if it's simultaneous communication. So I would just avoid it. All right. So when we say this matters because when you have an official meeting of a public body, that's when the notice requirements of the open meetings law kick in. So what are those requirements? Well, here's a summary of them. If it's a regular meeting, then the schedule has to be filed with the city clerk. And who's that person here? Who? Sabrina Oliver, right? And I have had the pleasure of meeting her. Seems delightful. So that's one requirement. And what do I mean by a regular meeting? Any idea? Your regularly scheduled meetings, that's right. You know you're going to meet every 2 weeks or once a month, the third Thursday of every month, that sort of thing. That would be a regular meeting. And so what you have to do is file a schedule with the clerk. And it has to be posted on the city's website somewhere. That's it. You don't have to put a sign on the door. You don't have to, nothing beyond that. That's all that's required for your regular meetings. If it's a special meeting, that is a meeting that's not on the regular meeting schedule, then you have to provide notice to the public at least 48 hours in advance. And that means you have to put a notice, a piece of paper, on the principal bulletin board of the city. Somewhere in town hall, there may be a bulletin board with announcements, or on the door of the public body's usual meeting room that gives the date, the time, the location, and the purpose of the special meeting. Now, for the regular meeting schedule, of course, you do have to give the date and the time and the location, but you don't have to state a purpose. But for a special meeting, the notice has to include the purpose of the meeting. And there can be problems if the body does things at the special meeting that aren't included in the statement of purpose. Why? Because you're doing things that the public had, or you're considering things the public had no way of knowing you might consider, because those things weren't put on the notice. That's the purpose of the notice, is to allow a member of the public to say, to analyze, evaluate whether he or she wants to go to the meeting. And also, if it's a special meeting, you have to send out notification to the sunshine list. So those can, the people on the sunshine list can be from the media or just members of the public who've asked to be notified when a special meeting takes place. And they can be notified by mail or email. Now, mail is not a great way to do it. Why? Because the meeting could have occurred before the person gets the notice if you wait. You know, if you wait until just you're right at the 48-hour mark to do it. So that's probably not the best way to do it anymore. And you also have to post notice of a special meeting on the website. Okay. Emergency meetings can only occur when there are circumstances that make an immediate meeting necessary. And probably that's not going to be something that most of you have to deal with. But there is no requirement to post notice of an emergency meeting. You do have to let media outlets know. So media outlets that are on your sunshine list have to be informed in the same way that you inform board members. So if you call everybody and say, hey, we've got to meet now, then you would call the media representatives and tell them, hey, we're going to have an emergency meeting. Then there's what's called a recessed meeting. Has anyone ever recessed a meeting? Okay. Okay. Well, of course the mayor has. What this, suppose, let's take the city council because that's the easiest example. They say they're holding a special meeting on a certain topic that's contentious, and they're not in a position to take action by the end of that meeting. They think they need more time to deliberate and discuss. Well, they can recess that meeting by saying, we're going to meet again on this date at this time and in this location. And if they do that, they don't have to provide any other kind of notice, except they do have to put it on the website. But they don't have to post notice like you do for a special meeting or anything like that. The theory being that people who were at the meeting and who would care to be there, who might care to be there for the conclusion of the business, will have heard the date, time, and location of the recessed meeting. That does not apply to a recessed meeting. That's a good question. The question was, does the 48-hour notice requirement apply to a recessed meeting? And the answer was no. Under the open meetings law, yeah. So the question was, if we're having a meeting, and what board are you with?
Housing Advisory Board.
Housing Advisory Board. So an advisory board meeting, if we're having a meeting that was properly noticed, whether a regular or special, and we decide we can't get through business and we want to reconvene later, can we do a recess meeting? And the answer under the open meetings law is yes. Now, we're talking about state law requirements that apply to all local public bodies when they conduct official meetings. But your governing board has the authority to prescribe procedures for subordinate entities. So you always have to go back and look at whatever local rule, procedural rules you might have as well. And I don't know what they are for you, so I can't comment on that. But under the open meetings law, the answer to your question is yes. Okay, now, the purpose of the open meetings law, or an obvious purpose of it, is to give the public the opportunity to know what governing or government bodies are doing. But there are some times when the open meetings law allows a public body to meet in closed session to discuss matters. So, to keep the public out, and we're going to talk about what some of those exceptions are. But before we do that, I would like to highlight the process. So the process is that you make a motion in open session that states the general purpose of the closed session. And it's great to even cite the statutory provision that under which you're meeting in closed session. So you don't start out a meeting in closed session. Okay, and I stress that you probably don't do it, but I have seen many committees and public bodies who have been under the impression that as long as we have a valid reason to be in closed session, we can just start out in closed session. You can't do that. You always have to start in open session and make a motion to go into closed session. All right, what are some of the reasons for which you can go into closed session? Well, you can do that when it's necessary to preserve the confidentiality of records that are confidential under state or federal law. Preserve the attorney-client privilege. Probably that's not an issue for most of you. I doubt you have attorneys at your meetings, right? Okay. Discuss economic development. There's some authority to do that. Probably you don't buy property on behalf of the city, right? So that you don't have to worry about that. Personnel board, I'm sure you go into closed session quite a bit, right? The personnel commission? Okay, so you don't know. All right, but when you're discussing the performance qualifications or appointment of public employees, that can be a basis for going into closed session. Now, where I have seen there's a temptation under for two of these closed session purposes for boards to stray beyond what's allowed. And the first one is the attorney-client privilege. It's so easy to say, well, we want to talk to the attorney, and then to go into closed session and allow the discussion to stray beyond whatever specific legal questions a body has for the attorney,
and then go and talk about, use that to, as an opportunity to talk about some general policy concern without having the public hear it. Well, the open meetings law specifically says that when a board meets in closed session for the purpose of consulting with its attorney, it can't use that as an excuse to talk about general policy matters. So if you've got legal questions for the attorney about the effect of certain things, like the effect of a policy, that's fine. But just a discussion about whether the policy is a good idea, whether we ought to do this or that, that's really not grounds for a closed session under the attorney-client privilege. The other exception is the personnel exception. Boards like to talk about general personnel issues in closed session. And that's, you can't do that under the open meetings law. You can talk about an individual employee or applicant, but that's really it. And I've seen some really creative attempts to get around this. And one of the things people will sometimes do is they'll say, suppose so-and-so, who's in X department, were to do this or that. So they'll think that, well, as long as I mention somebody's name, you know, I can get around the open meetings law. That's really not, I think, consistent with the spirit of the law, certainly. Yes? Yes, thank you. So, applications, and we're going to talk about that when we talk about the public records law. All right, so I haven't quite gotten there yet. But I'm talking about applications for employment, right? That would be, to review applications for employment, that would be a valid basis for going into closed session under the open meetings law. Reviewing applications for members to a membership on an appointed board, not. Okay, that's not. You're not city employees, right? You are apparently insane individuals who are crazy enough to volunteer to devote some of your spare time to the public business without remuneration, right? That's without pay, right? You are not covered by that exception. By the same token, it would be inappropriate for the council to go into closed session to talk about the performance of a council member. Can't do that either. If you've got something bad to say about one of your fellow elected officials, the open meetings law requires you to say it in public. Right. Okay, so any questions about the open meetings law? I need to move along a bit so we can get to our quiz at the end, which may be the most helpful part of all of this for you. Any questions about the open meetings law before we get to public records? Okay. So public records are records made or received in the transaction of public business. And I want to read you at least part of the definition, the statutory definition, so that you will appreciate just how broad it is. Public record or public records shall mean all documents, papers, letters, maps, books, photographs, films, sound recordings, magnetic or other tapes, electronic data processing records, artifacts, or other documentary material, regardless of physical form or characteristics, made or received pursuant to law or ordinance in connection with the transaction of public business by any agency of North Carolina government or its subdivisions. This is a subdivision. The state government, just so you know. So, pretty broad, right? Regardless of physical form or characteristics, right? So we're not just talking about paper by any stretch. And what the public records law does, basically, is give the public the right to inspect and copy any public record unless an exception applies. So it's broad and it's meant to be broad. Now, this is a key point, and one that when I was a practicing attorney for local government entities, I brought up over and over again. The public records law applies to
records, not information. A proper public records request is for something, a document, or not just tell me how many so-and-so, so-and-so, right? You got to ask for something. Another implication of this is that you don't have to create records that don't exist in order to provide information that, if it were on a record that already exists, would be a public record. Right? The public records law does not require you to create documents. Now, that gets a little tricky when you're talking about request for information that's on or held in a computer database. And the basic rule seems to be, if someone asks for a report or data that's held in a database, and you can easily produce it with a few queries, for example, then you're going to have to turn it over. But as a general rule, you don't have to create lists of this or that in order to provide information to people. They've got to ask for something that's actually an extant record. Okay, what is a record? And I've already read you the statutory definition. It's broad. Any questions? Do you have any examples in your mind? You're wondering, is this a public record? Yes. Was it sent to you in your capacity? Okay, sorry, thank you. So this is a question from a member of the Housing Authority Advisory Board who received an inquiry from a citizen,
an applicant,
about what?
Affordable housing strategies.
Affordable housing?
Okay,
that you have some, so the email was about affordable housing strategies in which this member has expertise. And the question is, was that a public record? Was it sent to you in your capacity as a member of the advisory board?
That's what I don't know.
Okay.
Was it because of my experience? But I'm on the board.
Right. Well, fortunately, in your case, we don't really have to reach a resolution on that question because you forwarded the email to the staff, Housing Authority staff. So they have definitely received that email in the transaction of public business. And so, yes, it is a public record. Now, that brings up a great point, and I'm sure I'll get to it in the slides, but I'll go ahead and make it now. It doesn't matter where the record is kept. So if you're transacting board business using your personal email account, those emails are public records that are subject to disclosure under the public records law. It doesn't matter that it's your personal email account. So just be aware of that. And I don't know, is there a policy here about using personal email accounts? There's not. So that's something to keep in mind. You don't avoid the obligation to turn over a public record by storing it in some private site. Okay? If it's made or received in the transaction of public business, it's subject to disclosure. Yes, sir. So the question is, tell me if I get this wrong, but I think the question is, if I'm using my personal email account to transact public business, who gets to go through my emails to find out whether I've got anything? And I hope your town has some way of approaching that. I don't know has that issue come up for you before?
to date, we haven't had that issue with an advisory board member. We have had that issue with staff. So there has been a public records request that said, we want all the emails between this person and this person regarding the topic of X. And so then, yes, we have an IT person who runs a report that, and don't ask me how this works because I do not know, but the report somehow pulls together all these emails, but sometimes it can be a huge amount of email, and we just have to then turn it over to the person who's requested it and let them go through them. If my understanding is that if such a query was made of an advisory board member, that probably our first step would be to ask you to turn over everything, so to ask you to go through your email to supply that information. And if the person requesting the records wasn't satisfied, then we'd probably need to talk to the attorney in the IT department. It would be probably an ongoing conversation about how to deal with that.
Yeah, the short answer is that the public records law doesn't say. And I'm not sure what authority the town would have to force you to give it access to your account, all right, if you didn't really want to. But what I would say is where it might really become an issue is if the person who wanted the records decided to sue. And then you might be compelled to provide access to your email account that way. Yes. So the question is, do I think you should have an email account devoted solely to town business? I'm reluctant to make recommendations like that, but it to me, that kind of approach seems like it could save a lot of headache. That's what I'd say about that. So the question is, should I have a disclaimer on my email that advises people that their email to me and my response to them could be subject to a public records request? I have that on mine, but that really doesn't govern whether something's a public record or not. Yeah. So it doesn't have anything to do with whether you're obligated to turn it over. But I would say, remember that the term, the acronym FOIA, is not a state law term. You're not subject to FOIA, to Freedom of Information Act. That's federal. Some states have public records laws that they call Freedom of Information Acts. But for us, it's the public records law. Sure.
I just a couple of these questions that I found helpful, like in litigation with discovery, whenever we're trying to go through lots of emails. One of the things that that can be helpful is if you have a private email and there's a public records request that seems to want to know what your emails are about this, rather than let somebody go through all of your email, if you run a search and then you certify that a search was run with, and then you specify what the query is that you produced for your of the search, that often can satisfy people. So, for example, you know, here are the emails. I certify that these are the results of searching my email using these keywords, blink, 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 blink. And then here they are, a chunk. And often that satisfies people who are in search of certain kinds of records. You know, you want to, and if I was asking you, I'd want you to attest that you're telling the truth and you didn't go and eliminate some. Also, with the question about having a separate email address for town business, that can be helpful. But I found that sometimes people then use that as an excuse to use their other email address as a way to get around it. So you need to be careful. That doesn't excuse you if you accidentally conduct public business with your other account that you didn't intend to have there. It's still discoverable. So, for example, there's a number of people in the community who will email me and on my Gmail email account, markkleinschmidt@gmail. I don't have any problem giving that. That's what it is. But you know, that doesn't protect your email to me from potentially becoming a public record just because you didn't send it to M. Kleinschmidt at Town of Chapel Hill. But some people actually think that. So, you know that you can't actually set up a special box that therefore it gives you permission, you know, a free place to play elsewhere. You don't get that.
Yeah, I think those are great points. Yes, sir. Well, so the question was, if I inadvertently delete an email that is a public record, well, you do have a retention schedule, I would assume, and so that governs when you can get rid of public records. And so that's a related but an animal that we can't really get into. The general rule I think for most emails is that you can get rid of them when their administrative value ends. So that's to a degree a subjective determination. But there are rules. They're promulgated by the Department of Cultural Resources by statute for the disposition of public records. And I don't know if you give any training on that or not. And actually, it's folks from the Division of Archives, of the State Archives, they do those trainings on retention schedules. Yes.
So if we send anything relevant to our staff liaison, does it
keep that? Okay, that is not a question I can answer because I don't know how your computer systems work. That's a whole can of worms. That we know. All right, like I said, it's the content, not the location. So as the mayor pointed out, even if you have a separate account that you set up just for purposes of your board, if you have any correspondence in any other account that made or received in the transaction of public business, it's subject to public records law. Okay, there are some exceptions, and the exceptions come up in one of two ways, and I have to be brisk here. There's some sets of information that the law says don't have to turn these over in response to a public records request. And an example of that would be utility billing records, right? The law says you don't have to turn these over in response to a public records request. It doesn't say you absolutely can't. So there's some discretion. Now, certain types of information that you'll find on billing records are covered by other statutes, and you can't release them under those other statutes. But there's not an absolute statutory prohibition on releasing that information. There's some statutes that say you cannot turn over these documents unless, you know, there's certain criteria met. And personnel records would be an example of that. Those ordinarily don't involve a situation where it's up to the governing board to decide whether you turn it over or not. Ordinarily, the rule for those is you can't disclose them. Let's see. Sorry, I'm technologically challenged. I don't think you really need to worry about the charge piece, but it is possible to charge direct costs for providing public records, not personnel time. So you're in most instances, you're literally charging the cost of the copies that are being made. Okay, drafts are public records. Draft documents are public records. You can't say, well, we're only going to release the final report. drafts are public records. No need to retain notes. I'm not sure. This presentation was put together by my colleague, Freda Bluestein, who is a real authority on these matters. I'm not sure exactly what she meant by no need to retain notes, because it depends. I know she didn't mean it as an absolute thing. So there might be an argument that if you have notes, you write some notes, they're solely for your own use. You don't share them with anybody. There may be an argument that something like that is not a public record. Depends on what you're doing. But oftentimes notes are shared. They are used to influence actions. And in those cases, I don't think you could just say we're just going to discard all notes. It would depend on what your retention schedule is. So, any questions before we move on to the quiz? I think you have the quiz questions. Okay. I keep forgetting. I'm not used to having to stand still, so I'm sorry. It's jarring my brain. Number one, open meetings law does not apply to advisory boards as long as they do not have final decision-making authority. True or false? I'm so glad you got that. If you had said true on that, I would probably have wept. A meeting solely, number two, among the staff of a public agency is not subject to the open meetings law. True or false? It's amazing how you can create uncertainty just by being silent. Generally, it's true. Generally, it's true. The open meetings law says a meeting that's purely that consists purely of staff members is not a that's not a public body, a group that consists purely of staff members. Now, if you have a group of staff members who've been delegated some decision-making authority by the governing body, it's possible in that situation that it would be a public body. But the general rule is a meeting purely of staff members is not a public body. Okay, an appointed board, number three, has created a subcommittee to develop a proposal and report back to the full board. There are three members. One member meets another member for coffee, and they discuss their ideas about how the proposal should be presented. Is this a meeting subject to the open meetings law? Yes. Very good. It is. Okay, someone said no, and I'd like to know why. It's a three-member group, so two's a majority. Yeah, that's fine. Now, could the two members get together just to have coffee? Right, because there's an exception for purely social gatherings. So if they're just getting together to have coffee and talk about how their kids are doing, that sort of thing, that's fine. That's not a violation of law. The public has no interest in that, right? It's purely personal. But if you do that, you have to avoid the temptation to start talking about board business. Number four, a public body may conduct its business by email as long as the public has access to copies of the email upon request. Why is it false? Yeah, this one is a little complicated. Suppose that the email exchange is not simultaneous. So say there's a proposed ordinance. We're going to require leashes on all pot-bellied pigs. And the council members exchange emails about that, but that it's not simultaneous in nature. And they agree via email, we're going to support this. But it's a decision. So what's your point? It's a decision, so your council can only act as a body, right? And can only act as a body in compliance with the notice requirements of the open meetings law. So they can't conduct business. They can't make decisions by email. All right. Now, can two council members exchange emails about the How many members are on your council, Mr. Mayor? Nine. So you could have three, four members exchange emails about it and not have a meeting in violation of the open meetings law. It is not advisable. Right.
We don't put the town attorney on those emails.
Great candor. It was a joke. Okay, number five, a board or commission may meet in closed session to discuss applicants for appointment to that board or commission. Excellent. It is false. Six, I'm up against my time. Can I have a couple more minutes? Okay. Number six, so given everything we've talked about, let's discuss the following suggestions for locations and formats for meetings. A, meeting in the home of a board member. What do you think? I would say it's ill-advised because you don't know how many members of the public might wish to attend. And also, if you think about it, if you're a member of the public, it's one thing to go to town hall, but going to someone else's home, you might think that feels a little invasive. It might be something of a disincentive to you. It might discourage you from going. So I'd say that's not a great idea. Okay, B, electronic meetings using video conference software, provided that notice is given. You can't do that, right? You have a policy that says you can't. And I'll just tell you, the law is unclear on this. Freda Bluestein, I mentioned her earlier, she wrote a wonderful bulletin. It's a type of publication we put out on remote participation in board meetings. And she concludes in there, you know, that it's not really clear, the authority of local governments to transact business remotely is not clear. So you could run into a problem if, say, you're relying on someone who's participating remotely to provide a quorum, or that person provides the deciding vote in something. It may be there's some basis to challenge that. Okay, C, a coffee shop. What do we say here? A coffee shop subject to relocation, got to have all the facts, subject to relocation to town hall if attendees exceed the space available. Yeah, that would not be acceptable because of the problem with notice. All right, public records really quickly. Emails relating to the transaction of public business made or received on privately owned computers or using private email accounts are subject to public access under the public records law. True or false? Verb. Number two, applications for appointment to local government advisory boards are public records. Three, the home phone numbers of applicants to and members of town advisory boards may be redacted from any public records on which they appear if there is a request for access to those records. You hope that it is true. You fear that it is false. So the answer is false. Certain kinds of personal information are confidential, even if they're contained in public records, but not your phone number. So example of that kind of information, the kind of information that would be private and that would be redacted and that, in fact, would be a violation of law for the town to disclose it, even if it's on a record that's otherwise public, would be Social Security number, bank account, driver's license numbers. That's information that the town can't release, but your phone number is not covered. And your address. But, okay, and that might concern you, but how many, pardon? So, Ms. Phillips' comment was the town does have to release your name and your phone number if requested. What I would say is, technically, the request would have to be for a record on which that information is contained. They don't just have to say, yeah, here's the phone number. Right. So it'd have to be a request for a record. All right, number four, a citizen alleges that the planning board is biased in favor of friends and relatives of board members. The citizen requests that the town provide a list of all development applications from friends and relatives of board members that have been approved within the past 5 years. Must the town provide the list? Well, what's being requested here? A list? All right, raise your hand if you say no, don't have to provide it. Raise your hand if you say yes. Raise your hand if you don't know. All right. Raise your hand if you stopped listening about 15 minutes ago. Okay, there's somebody in the back. Yeah. Are you going to have friends, a friends column on there? Probably not. Okay, the answer is no, unless for some crazy reason you already have the list. All right. Like I pointed out, you don't have to create records. Now, if it's a request that's reframed in terms of specific applications from specific people or all applications that have been received within a certain time frame, that would be different. All right, number five. Was there a question? I don't know if you make your applications to town boards available on the web for development projects. You do. Okay. Number five. State law requires all public records to be maintained for a minimum period of 3 years. That is false. Like I said, there's a retention schedule, and that's what governs. And records of short-term value don't have to be retained. And that's covered to a degree on the handout that I hope you have, right? That should be behind your questions, open meetings law requirements, and okay. That's a great source of additional information. Okay, last question, and then I will sit down. A consultant hired by the town to develop an analysis of community policing strengths and weaknesses has prepared a draft report. Since some of the recommendations may be controversial, the consultant provides a preliminary draft to the police chief for review before submitting it to the advisory committee and the town council. A member of the public finds out about the report and requests a copy. Does the public have a right to a copy at this point? Yes, it does. There is, like I said, there's no exception for drafts. You've been an excellent group, and you have mastered the material. And I thank you for your attention.
So I want to just thank Trey again. I think when I asked him to come speak to our advisory board group, he probably wasn't anticipating the level of sophisticated questions that you guys were asking. But I think that he did really well. So I wanted to thank him one more time. And then I'm going to call up our final speaker for today. I'm going to take my own advice about pulling this over. Okay, there we go. So our final person for today is Phil Mason. And he is, Phil Mason moved to Chapel Hill 18 years ago from Massachusetts to attend the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Department of City and Regional Planning. He's worked for the town for 16 years. He was first with the planning department and now with our newly restructured planning and sustainability department, which is a reflection of what the mayor was talking about earlier about how we are now trying to realign our workforce better with the Chapel Hill 2020 goals. Phil has reviewed many development projects, large and small, over the years, and he recently became the town's development services manager. So he's going to be sharing with you today some information about our process.
Thanks, Jennifer. Good morning, everyone, and thanks so much for being here today. I'm going to give you an overview of the town's development review process and also talk a bit about the role of advisory boards in that. There may be some advisory board members here today whose board isn't directly involved in the development review process, but I think you may find this interesting nonetheless. Our agenda today includes an overview of the review process and also advisory board's role, and also I'd like to answer any questions you may have. And if you could, please hold your questions to the end. First, let's have a look at the approval types that the town's involved in. There are many different types of development in Chapel Hill, and they're divided into one of two paths in the town review and approval process. There are town council approvals and also planning commission approvals on the one hand, and staff level approvals on the other. Note that the Community Design Commission and Historic District Commission also provide preliminary approvals to administrative approvals that staff does, such as lighting, elevation, and buffer approvals that the CDC does, and also certificates of appropriateness that the Historic District Commission does. The highest level of review includes town council approvals, with advisory board recommendations for special use permits, master land use plans, major subdivisions, and rezonings. Next are planning board approvals of site plan review applications and also minor subdivisions. These are smaller scale with less intensity than the corresponding SUP and major subdivision approvals that the council does. And finally, there are staff administrative approvals of zoning compliance permits, from form district compliance permits and development agreement permits to just many types of zoning compliance permits. I'll provide a little more detail now. What comes to mind when you think of a council special use permit and rezoning approval process? The 140 West development on Franklin Street is a recent council approval that benefited from advisory board recommendations, resulting in a better outcome for the community. This approval process is enhanced by the advisory board role, by the advisory role that boards and commissions play for the council. Another example of a council approved development is the 123 West Franklin development directly across the street from 140 West. Shown in this rendering and currently going through the final plan approval process. Other recent approvals include Shortbread Lofts, Chapel of the Cross redevelopment, Ronald McDonald House, and Southern Orange Government Services Campus. All of these projects required review and recommendations by town advisory boards. Another example of a council approval process is the Ephesus Fordham Form District rezoning, for which advisory boards provided recommendations. This is a new approach the town is taking to enhance economic development in an underutilized part of Chapel Hill. Additional examples of council approvals are Southern Village and Meadowmont that included multiple types of applications in each of those projects. These are recent examples of Planning Commission site plan approvals, beginning in the upper left and going clockwise: Goodwill at Timberline Shopping Center, Orange County Animal Shelter, and Colbreth Middle School Science Wing expansion. Other approvals include Townside Terrace Condominiums on Hillsborough Street and the Goddard School Daycare on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Finally, administrative approvals by staff are mostly zoning compliance permits. The bulk of these approvals are residential development projects and include everything from new homes to decks to affordable housing, as well as historic district projects that also require the certificate of appropriateness from the HDC that I mentioned earlier. Administrative approvals also include a broad array of permits, clockwise from the upper left, such as site development permits on the UNC campus, form district permits, development agreement permits, and also simple changes of use to existing commercial development, this shown on Franklin Street. This graphic shows the breakdown of the percentage of development applications that were approved in the fiscal year 2012-2013 by advisory boards, staff, and council. Though many more applications are reviewed and approved by staff, in terms of just raw numbers, the applications reviewed by advisory boards and council are normally larger in scope and also much more time-consuming to approve. Okay, after all that background, I know you want to know a little more about the advisory board role in development review and council approvals. Why does the council ask for advisory board input to development projects, and what are your respective roles among the various boards and commissions? As advisory board members, you're council-appointed representatives of the community. The council relies on your recommendations about development applications to inform their decision-making process. Advisory boards are expected to provide council with information and perspective to inform its decisions, to serve as council's eyes and ears on issues and matters related to the board's charge, and also to offer additional opportunities for discussion and public issues. What kind of feedback and recommendations should each advisory board provide to the council as there are a wide range of issues that are part of development applications? Each advisory board has a very specific charge, and therefore each board's comment should be informed by that charge. A question worth asking when reviewing a development application is, does a particular conversation, comment, or recommendation speak to the board's charge and the special perspective of each advisory board? These are just two examples of charges of advisory boards. The Transportation and Connectivity Board's charge is geared towards transportation, while the Planning Board's has a broader view of development. Each advisory board has a unique charge that serves to focus the perspective of its review. It is worth familiarizing yourselves with your advisory board's charge. The last question I want to pose regarding development review by advisory boards is, who are advisory boards serving? Development projects can stir up many emotions and different points of view. I know you're all on advisory boards because you take great interest in what happens in Chapel Hill, including changes to the development landscape. Maybe more so if proposed development is near one's home. This is clear to anyone who has attended a Chapel Hill Town Council or Advisory Board meeting. Yet, despite the passions around new development, each Advisory Board member serves the larger Advisory Board they're on, and each Advisory Board serves the entire community at Chapel Hill. That's all I have. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have. And I've provided a handout that shows the sequence of steps in a council development review process and how advisory boards fit into that sequence. And I can answer questions. Jennifer mentioned to me it may be better if you want to ask questions if you come up to the microphone, then it's clear on the recording that we're making of this, of the meeting. Anyone? There's not a quiz. At least there's that. Hi, Lauren.
Hello. Could you just take a, could you just, well, this may be unfair, but could you briefly say what a new project would do under the new system? You know, from day one, just walk us through this thing, or just say what would happen over the year period or whatever.
Okay. That's not unfair at all. I have a chart that I can follow, too. Because, as you all know, our development review process is rather complex for the larger applications. Typically, what happens is an applicant has an idea for a development proposal. They may approach the Planning and Sustainability Department first to talk about that idea. Before submitting a concept plan application, which, depending on the scale, and I can't tell you those thresholds off the top of my head, may go to the CDC and the council as well. But if it doesn't rise to that level, it may not have a concept plan at all. The staff writes a memo. The application goes away, and we may never see it again, because the applicant might get feedback from the council that it's not maybe not not the best idea for Chapel Hill, maybe not the best idea given the scale or the location of the development, and sometimes we don't see applicants again. If it receives more favorable feedback from the CDC and the council, we'll, after some period of time, we will receive a formal application or applications from an applicant. Let's say it could be a rezoning and a special use permit, for example. Prior to submitting that application, the applicant will have a pre-application meeting with staff, and they'll submit their application. It'll go through the review process with staff, which normally takes a couple of months. The applicant takes those comments away from all the town departments that review development and revises their application and returns with an application that's now ready to go forward to all of you, to town advisory boards, and ultimately the council. Staff reviews the application again, makes additional comments, which are the raw material for the memos we write, the staff reports for development, and it proceeds to advisory boards. You review the project, make recommendations to the council. It goes to town council for a public hearing, and after the public hearing, roughly a month later, project will return to the council after the council receives public feedback and comment. Staff will respond to that public feedback and comment. It'll come back for action, or what is called the business meeting, and the council will vote on the project. And there will be a lot of conditions that go along with any large-scale development, as most of you know. And after that, after an approval, after some period of time, the applicant comes back for final plan review, which is an administrative process. It comes to staff, and they essentially respond to each one of the stipulations in a special use permit and show us how they are complying with those stipulations. And that process usually goes through several rounds of, it's an iterative process, several rounds of review and comment and revisions by the applicant until the applicant is ready to be approved. They get a zoning compliance permit, followed by an engineering construction permit by the engineering department, and then ultimately a building permit from the inspections division, where they can actually start work on the project. And that's the whole thing. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. OK. council approve? Oh, yeah, sorry. Julie wanted to know about how the form-based code project is differentiated from the special use permit process. The council approved last spring the Ephesus Fordham form-based zoning district. That entire area has been rezoned, and the approval was such that the form-based zone is very specific. It's prescriptive what applicants must come in with in terms of scale and design of buildings, and that comes directly to staff as an administrative application process, like a final plan application. We've just received our first application for the, I think it's called the Village Plaza on Elliott, thank you. It's on Elliott Road, which I have not looked at yet. Other staff have been reviewing that, and that will go through the same iterative process. We'll comment, the applicant will make changes, come back with a revised application, and then ultimately that will be approved. So did that answer your question? Pardon? It goes to the CDC as well. That's correct. This is the first one, so we've been doing special use permits for years, and this is the first application of this sort that's come before the town. It goes to the CDC that reviews elevations of the project and prior to getting a zoning compliance permit. Thank you. No, that's correct. No other advisory board gets to review the project. That's correct. Let me just follow up on that. I'm sorry. The advisory board input for the Ephesus Fordham form-based district was, well, prior to it being approved by the town council. That was the input on that. So it's different than special use permits and other application types. How does staff determine which projects go before which boards? There are certain array of advisory boards that review development projects. We have new advisory boards now, and there are others that don't review development. For example, the personnel board doesn't review development. The Board of Adjustment doesn't review a development in our typical review process, although the Board of Adjustment rules on development-related matters. So our boards that do review development, they would receive each development project. Anything else? Thank you.
So I want to say thank you to Phil. I think this is a really complex topic, and the reason we wanted to give you a little bit of an overview today is just to kind of start to be sure that all of our advisory board members have a shared background of information so that when you're looking at development, if you do, you can understand our process. So I want to thank you all for your patience today. We have one final thing to do. I promise it won't take long. I've got some evaluation forms here. I ask that you take a few minutes to fill them out. If you need a pen, we'll get you a pen. We really use these to inform our planning for the following year. We find it really helpful to see what sessions were helpful to people and which ones folks thought they could either do without or we could do something different. It also is an opportunity for you to share with us what you would have liked to learn today, maybe things that we didn't cover that you wish we had. So I'm going to pass those out, and if you want to fill them out and put them on the table as you leave, that would be fantastic. So thank you all for coming.